Welcome everyone for the afternoon session. We are here with Aditi Bacci from Fordham University. It's your time, Aditi.
Yes, thanks. So first of all, thank you so much for having me here. I'm really grateful to be a part of this. I know it's an enormous undertaking to have people from all over the world at a workshop like this, and I really appreciate the effort that went into putting it together. So thank you, and it's already been a good conversation so far. So my paper is on consent and disagreement. Just to give you a little bit of background, my writing is mostly in the area of contracts. I think I must be the shortest of the speakers thus far. I need to raise the seat, sorry. Oh well, I guess I'll just stay small and humble here. So my background is in contract theory, and this paper is obviously coming, is an instance of contract theory, but I tried to branch out a little bit from my kind of core writing, a lot of it which has been about distributive justice or interpretation, things that are rather more tied to obvious questions in contract doctrine. This paper is not really oriented to proposing any particular reform of contract law, but just to ponder a question in contract that I think has implications outside of contract and actually private law generally. And that is on the nature of consent and how it functions to manage relationships. So I start with the idea of a reactive discord. So this is a term that I'm hoping to coin. it's the idea that two people in an interaction gone wrong can react differently to it, not just because they occupied different positions within the interaction, but because they interpret the moral significance of what happened differently. So, for example, if I hit your car with my car, we might disagree not just about the fact of what happened, whether you were speeding or whether I was driving straight, but also what level of care I owed you, and how diligently how carefully you should have been driving, right? So we can disagree not just on the facts of what happened, but about what we owed each other. And the result of disagreeing about that is that we are going to disagree in our reactive attitude toward the event. So in the concept of a reactive attitude, I am drawing from someone named Peter Strawson, who distinguished broadly between personal reactions and objective reactions, or personal reactive attitudes and objective reactive attitudes. So the idea is that when you react to someone having committed an action that injured you in a personal way, you take them to have been responsible for the injury they inflicted on you, and you presuppose their agency in having committed this wrong against you. By contrast, if you react to an event with an objective fashion, you react as if they were an object, right? So to some extent, we might have this reaction toward children, right? So when a child does something, when a child knocks over a glass of water off of a table, or maybe a clearer example would be a cat. But if someone who's not a full-fledged moral agent does something like this, we don't experience anger. We don't blame them. We are not, or at least it would be improper for us to do so. Upon reflection, we would not react in any kind of morally charged way to that event. We would see it not like very different than the tree being hit by lightning and falling on our house, right? Only when we think that there's an agent behind the action that has the capacity for moral responsibility do we react with an attitude of, say, blame. Now, he was concerned with the distinction between personal and objective reattitudes as part of an argument for freedom. The idea is that it is so much a part of our interactions that we have these personal reactive attitudes that our normal way of interacting presupposes freedom. This is not that's not my project, but I nevertheless want to borrow this idea of a reactive attitude, that when something happens to us, we tend to react to the agent that brought about the harm in some critical fashion. And also I want to highlight that the person who committed the harm, or the injuring party, also is likely to react to the incident in some way that reflects their assumption of their own agency and also their attitude toward the victim as a moral agent too, right? So both parties are going to be reacting in a way that presupposes the moral agency of the, of themselves and the other. And so what I want to try to do is suggest that there is a value to reactive harmony and a cost to reactive discord. What is reactive harmony? Reactive harmony is where my attitude as the harm inflictor, I'm trying to use as neutral language as possible here, my attitude as the harm inflictor is kind of analytically compatible with your attitude as the victim of, or as the harm sufferer. Right? So we both regard the action that resulted in harm in terms that are compatible. Right? So I'm going to get into this in a little bit more detail in a moment, but for example, if you, in a moment of anger, you know, slap me across the face, and this is a big thing in the U.S. right now, there's a kind of notable example of this. If I, as the slapper, think that I, you know, that I was culpable and wrong to do this, and then you, as the victim, also agree that I was culpable and wrong to do this, then we have a kind of reactive harmony. Does that extinguish the wrong? No, right? So the wrong is still there. And there's still a negative moral value associated with that wrong. But there is something positive about the fact that we are aligned in our regard for what happened, in our kind of moral interpretation of the event. I'll talk more about the different ways in which there can be reactive discord or harmony. So what is the value of reactive harmony and or the cost of reactive discord? Well, I want to try to highlight three kinds of potential value from it. One is personal. By personal, I mean that it just makes us, it feels good when we are on the same page as the people we're interacting with, right? That however bad you feel when someone has slapped you across the face wrongfully, it feels that much worse if they don't even regard it as wrong, if they thought it was just, you know, that they were entitled to do it, if they have some kind of excuse or justification that they're invoking wrong, you know, incorrectly for what they did. There's a kind of utilitarian loss associated with experiencing this discord between people. I think I want to kind of lump in there also the way in which this undermines the quality of interactions and relationships, right? So it's such a basic part of our dealing with other people that we want to see the world in the same way, that if we don't see this world the same way on the moral dimension, it compromises our confidence in our own perception. So to make an analogy here, if I say, you know, perhaps some of you have had this feeling of being slightly unsettled when you look at a picture and you say, that's purple, and the other person says, no, that's blue. And in that moment where you are describing the same image differently, you come to realize all the ways in which your perception is uncertain in general, right? And then you might worry that you're going through the world seeing things differently than all of those around you, right? So that's already unsettling. So that's unsettling just even in terms of, you know, visual perception. It happens in the context of language, right? If you realize that that you're not using language in the same way as someone else, that this feeling of constraint, that you can't cooperate and communicate with people properly, if this basic threshold of mutual intelligibility is not met. Well, I think that reactive harmony plays a similar role because our perception of our normative situation, of the moral dimension of our world, is also, if not kind of foundational, to our kind of sense of who we are and how we fit into the world and how we are going to navigate it. So to the extent others are not reacting in the same way as us, that is in a way that's not compatible with us, it unsettles our sense of our footing in the world, so to speak. So there's this value to be had then from reactive harmony just on a personal level. I think there's arguably also a moral value. I'm not sure whether in the end I'm going to keep this as a separate category than the moral value. I think I have to think more about that, and I'm happy to hear from you about what you think. I'm inclined to say that it's not just that it generates this subjective value for people, but that there's also objectively something like getting closer to the truth of the matter, or there's a value to public discourse as generated by interpersonal discourse that produces truths in a society, and that the quality of that discourse and its capacity to kind of move forward and over time depends on there being on reaching common ground in our interpretation of individual events. So that's another possibility of that there's not only personal value but moral value in that sense. And then finally, and of particular importance in the context of private law, there is systemic value for the legal system. So here I want to distinguish between two kinds of ways in which, let's say a few distinctions. So one thing is to say that in any given instance where one person inflicts harm on another, there is a value to the legal system in the two parties having, you know, compatible reactive attitudes. Well, you know, what exactly is the state? What exactly are the stakes for the legal system? Well, the most obvious is just the threat of violence, right? So there's a kind of a pragmatic interest in the parties reacting to the case in the same way. There's also just the marginal benefit to social harmony that's to be derived from a particular case being kind of resolved in a full-fledged sense. But I don't want to limit it just to the cumulative benefit of resolving individual cases. It's also about the value to the legal system over time, so the kind of dynamic value of promoting reactive harmony. That is to say, when you and I have a dispute and we come to see it in ways that are compatible, or at least we come to some kind of resolution about, if not our moral rights, then at least what our legal rights and obligations are. If we agree on what those are with the assistance of a verdict from the court and some judicial reasoning, hopefully coming along with it, then the next time people are interacting, they have the benefit of this guidance as to what people owe each other, right? So it's not that, you know, each time I'm making a decision about how to drive, I am kind of sui generis thinking about, well, you know, there's the consider, you know, how much is this person's life worth? How much is my interest in getting to work on time worth? And, you know, working from bottom up, right? Rather, I can use past decisions of the court that find certain behaviors acceptable and others not as guidance about what I may or may not do. And so that there's less likely to be conflict or these kind of problematic harm doing in the first place. And when it happens, it's likely to be resolved in a kind of smoother way without it ever arriving to the level of conflict. And so I want to just here make a small little footnote here, which is that I don't take disharmony and disagreement and conflict to be all the same thing, although certainly in the draft as it is, I haven't kind of systematically disentangled these. Discord is just, two things that are not fitting together. So I'm literally thinking, if you're on a keyboard, you press two notes, they don't go together. They're not fighting each other necessarily, but they don't go together, right? Disagreement is a kind of a specification of the particular kind of discord that it's kind of like the explanation for the source of discord in this context. You disagree about your rights and obligations, and that produces this discord in your reactions to it. And I take conflict to be something else, which is a more active stance of opposition or a kind of a struggle towards something, right? So I want one thing and you want something else. Disagreement doesn't necessarily doesn't necessarily produce conflict. So, for example, you could have hegemonic stability where I think that you're wronging me, but I know that there's no point in my trying to resist. So then there's no kind of active conflict. But nevertheless, there's, we disagree about what's right and proper, and there's kind of disharmony about our attitude toward the way we're interacting. Okay, so there's not just a value to the legal system of, in each case, resolving decisions, achieving resolution in individual cases, but also to value over time in having people have the benefit of looking to past decisions to resolve these questions. That's kind of like the guiding benefit. There's also kind of benefits of efficacy and legitimacy for the legal system. To the extent we take the judgments of courts to be authoritative on not necessarily the moral question, but at least the legal question of what we owe each other, that is going to allow for the law to kind of be execute itself at a lower cost and just more effectively. Right? If people are constantly ignoring the law and resisting the law, it's much more it's less likely that we're going to achieve actual rule of law. If people internalize legal directives, then you're more likely to achieve that kind of rule of law. It's also a matter of legitimacy. And I mean legitimacy in the kind of Weberian sense of do most people actually regard the state as appropriately producing these directives? So if we take the state to be kind of answering in a reliable way, and I'm intentionally kind of being nebulous about what it means to say that it's reliable, but if we take the court to be, if we look to the court in this fashion, then we are more likely to see the court as legitimate the next time, you know, when it comes our turn to go to court and have the court tell us what to do. So we will have, you know, this pattern of the court playing this role, which then confers legitimacy on it as it, you know, plays this role in each additional case. And I see the value of the legal system in these different respects is all kind of really quite basic to the role that the law plays. All of it mitigates the way in which law has to rely on the coercive powers of the state to govern, right? So to the extent we don't internalize anything about the state, the state's directives, the legal norms, to the extent we don't look to those norms at all for guidance, the state is going to have to rely much more extensively on its coercive powers to actually, effectualize its rules. And so that's going to just result in a more authoritarian state. So we have a kind of basic interest in the law fulfilling this function in a way that everyone commonly understands it to be doing. Okay, so these are all reasons why we might favor or we might want the law to be successful in producing some degree of reactive harmony. Not that it will ever achieve perfect reactive harmony, only that it should be an engine for reactive harmony as opposed to, say, an engine for dissent. Dissent in a particular sense. Okay, so I want to now turn to what exactly reactive discord means. So far I'm just talking about, you know, why we should care one way or the other about it. So again, I'm relying here on the Strassonian reactive attitudes, and I'm all within the category of his personalized reactions. So one of the first things I want to do in this paper is try to construct these three kinds of reactive pairs. Reactive pairs are reactions by harm doers and harm sufferers that are kind of in principle compatible. And so when you have a kind of matching reactions or correlative or consistent reactions, you've got reactive harmony. When they are not matching, then you've got reactive discord. So this is a little bit difficult to orally present, but this is actually an instance where a chart would be good, but I don't have one in my paper either because I never do charts, but I should maybe do one. Let's say that the example I gave before was somebody wrongfully slaps another person. Ideally, the wrongdoer would feel guilt, and the victim would feel what I call indignation. Now, these words are all used to mean a million different things, and so there's no great, I can't say that the way I'm using indignation is always the way people use the word indignation, but I think it's at least one plausible meaning to ascribe to the concept. So if you have reactive harmony, the person who committed the wrong understands that it was wrong, understands that they're blameworthy, and they feel guilty about it. Similarly, the harm sufferer understands that their harm was not just a harm but a wrong, and assigns blame and culpability, to the speaker, or not to the speaker, to the, not to me, to the wrong, to the harm inflictor, for the interaction. So, although of course they're at odds with each other, right? And they nevertheless, there's a kind of compatibility in the way they are interpreting events from a moral point of view. I want to distinguish this from another reactive pair, which I'm going to call remorse and resentment. So remorse, again, all words that have more than one meaning, so I'm giving you my particular meaning. Remorse I'm using to refer to a situation where you have inflicted harm on someone else and you understand yourself to be responsible for it, although you were not culpable. Right, so generally, in private law theory, a big popular concept for many years, at least in the U.S., was, and I think in the U.K., was outcome responsibility. Outcome responsibility only requires control and foreseeability. Right, so even if you're, for example, merely negligent in a way that's consistent with how people behave all the time, right, you're just driving along and you're not careless or reckless any more than anybody else driving, but you just have the misfortune. Actually, let's just say that you're driving at the speed limit, right? You're not breaking any law. You're not breaking any rule. But somebody runs into your path and you hit them and they're significantly injured, it would be improper for you to walk away from that saying, well, you know, I follow the speed limit, so I feel nothing, right? Like, I am no differently situated in relation to this injury than the other guy behind me, right? Because it was just chance that you ran in front of me rather than the other guy. Like, it could just as well have been him. That would be an improper reaction because it was you. And there were choices that you made that resulted in the injury, even if they were not choices we think you ought not to have made, right? You relate to the action was very much yours. It's not the same thing as somebody pushing you, right? You're differently situated than if the car behind you had actually rammed into your car, which then propelled your car into the pedestrian. In that case, you wouldn't feel the same remorse as I'm talking about it. Remorse is when you were driving, you were in full control of the car, and you hit this person. So you should have what has been called agent regret. On the flip side of that, ideally, you would have resentment. Now, again, same caveat defining these terms as I, for my purposes. Resentment is when you understand that the other person was not culpable, right? They're not an evil person they're not like a murderer who was out to kill you, right? Nor are they like a sociopath who was driving in a crazy way. They were following all the rules, but nevertheless, you resent them for what they did to you, right? Like they have significantly injured you in some way, and it was them that did it, not anyone else. Just the fact that it could have been someone else is not important. It's not trivial, but it's also important that it was in fact them. So you regard them as having a special responsibility for your loss, even if you don't think that they are culpable for it. So again, here you would, in an ideal world, you would have kind of correlative attitudes of remorse and resentment. Now, I hope right away you see where you might have reactive discord, because you can imagine in a certain situation the victim thinking that the driver was not merely kind of unlucky in some sense, but also actually culpable, while the driver sees herself as merely kind of appropriately remorseful, right? So the attitude of the victim might ascribe a higher degree of moral responsibility, something approaching culpability, whereas the actual harm doer might accept a lesser degree that amounts only to that's causing nothing more than remorse. Okay, so far we've got guilt, indignation, and we've got remorse, resentment. And then the final correlative pair, and I don't take these three to be exhaustive, but to be kind of three major sets of reactions that one might have. The last set is regret and disappointment. So I'm obviously using regret in a different sense than agent regret. Regret here is one where you actually have no particular responsibility, but you are just kind of caught up in events, right? That you have a kind of wholly accidental connection to the thing that happened, but nevertheless, it was you. So this is borrowing on an example that was used for entirely different purposes. But let's say you're standing on, so we've had a lot of incidents recently, people, not to frighten you off of New York, but people being pushed into the subway tracks, right? So imagine that you're standing on the subway platform and someone is pushed into the subway tracks. And you're thinking, gosh, like, I need to save this person, but I actually don't know how I'm supposed to save this person, right? And you kind of walk over to the edge and you think, should I lean down and try to pull them up? But then what if I get pulled in, right? Should I, what should I do? It's not clear, right? So in that moment, I think it's almost certainly not the case that you are guilty, right? You're certainly not guilty, right? As you haven't done anything, actually blameworthy. It's likely that you don't even need to have remorse if there wasn't a clearly rational course of action here that would result in likely saving the person who fell in. But gosh, it would be weird if you didn't at least regret that you weren't able to save the person, right? And of course, it's not your fault that you happened to be there, but you were there. And it's now a part of your life story that you, in some literal sense, stood by while someone got killed, right? So you should have regret. It's not the same thing as remorse, which has a fuller sense of responsibility, and it's not the same thing as guilt. Now, there are those who would, there are those who deny the category of remorse, and there are probably many more who would deny the category of regret, and see it as a kind of psychological error, right? That just the happenstance of your being there makes you think that you're specially connected, but actually you're not, right? You're no more responsible or connected than, the bench on the platform, right? Like you are basically like an object in the periphery that had no agency whatsoever. It's not appropriate for you to feel regret. I am kind of buying an account where one does appropriately regret the incident, but nothing in my kind of larger point depends on your agreeing to that particular notion of responsibility, or indeed to any, this little schemata that I've provided. So what is disappointment? Disappointment is the flip side of regret. I know that it wasn't your fault. I know that you're not responsible, but I'm disappointed in you. Like, I kind of see you as bound up in my misfortune, right? I see my misfortune is connected to you in some way. Okay, so again, not too much for my purposes hangs on your buying these categories. What I really want you to buy, though, is the idea that there is this possibility of fit, right? That when I react as a harm doer, that it correlates in principle with some reaction on the part of the harm sufferer. And so whether you buy into this particular schemata that I've provided or not, I'm looking for you to buy into the idea of reactive harmony. And this was in reactive discord as two possibilities. And this was really intended to flesh out what that could mean. Okay, so why would we ever have reactive discord as opposed to kind of perfect harmony in the sense? Like, why would you ever see a harm doer experience guilt while a harm sufferer feels resentful? I think it's conceivable that sometimes you would have a harm doer feel guilty while the victim feels mere disappointment. I think that that's not inconceivable either. So why would you ever have this kind of mismatch? Well, there's basically two main drivers of discord, I think. One is kind of the more obvious, disagreement about facts, right? So we might disagree about whether you could have saved me. We might disagree about how carefully you were driving and how carefully you ought to drive. Oh, sorry, no, don't do that, how carefully you ought to drive. How carefully you were driving, right? So we might disagree about the facts. And of course, if we disagree about the facts, we will also disagree about how we ought to react to what happened and what kind of attitude we ought to bring to that interaction. But there's another kind of disagreement that I think is as important, and it's the more interesting one, maybe. And this is the disagreement about obligation. That is disagreement about what we owed each other to begin with. So I might say, I concede that you were driving 30 miles an hour. I don't know what that is in kilometers, but fewer. I know that you were driving at a certain speed. But I think that even though the speed limit was, 40, that you should have driven more carefully, maybe because we know that there are people that have to walk in the road driving their carts with recycled materials, right, like we were talking about earlier. So we might disagree about what you owed me, even if we don't disagree about what happened. Now here we need to distinguish between moral and legal obligation, right? So we might disagree about morally what you were obligated to do, and then we might, separate from that, disagree about legal obligation. And of course, these come apart. So we could agree that your legal obligation was only to drive below the speed limit, but then think morally you ought to have driven more slowly than that. Or we might say that actually your legal obligation tracks your moral obligation in some way, so that if you were driving above the speed limit, that would be an easy case. But the bare fact that you weren't driving above the speed limit doesn't mean that you're immune from legal liability. So there could be disagreement about obligation, and there could be disagreement about facts, and both of these kinds of disagreement produce discord. So now I want to turn to contract as a particular kind of interaction that sometimes gives rise to conflict. Now, you might have the reaction that, well, contract seems like a pretty low-stakes environment for conflict, for discord, because it's most contracts have a commercial character. People are not emotional about their contracts. They're not going to be, you might think that it's an amoral sphere where people tend not to think that there's any kind of moral obligation, so the stakes are kind of low. There's only legal obligation, and so that's and that's kind of clearly announced by the courts, and so there's nothing to be, there's just not a space where this matters. I think that it is a space that matters, both in terms of what goes on in the context of contract and for its implications outside of contract. So within contract, even when we have exchanges between sophisticated parties, I think that we can have, there are always natural persons behind those, right? Now, those natural persons may be the actual agents that made decisions, but they are also natural persons who are stakeholders, like employees or consumers or, you know, other people that are affected by, or, you know, even taxpayers. There are many, even when we're talking about legal persons that are not natural persons contracting, usually there's some ultimate effect, upshot for natural persons. And so there are people who care what happens in contract. It's not as if everyone is indifferent to that. And that's even, of course, putting aside the large category of contracts that do involve natural people, where it's, of course, more easy to see why a natural person would have some kind of reactive attitude to the event. So, you know, even within the realm of contract, I think it's kind of, there's plenty of room for people to interpret events differently and implicating all the different negative values associated with discord that I spoke of before. But also, part of my interest in contract is that I see it as a particular space where consent does a lot of work. And I want to see this, I regard this as a kind of exploration of some of the problems with consent in relationships, and I don't think that's limited to contract. Contract should be kind of, I think, the easiest case for consent. There's going to be context outside of private law where it's going to be, you know, much more fraught. So in some ways, this is like dipping your toes into the messiness of consent. Okay, so when would we have reactive discord in contract? Well, on the face of it, we might think that, you know, it's not just that reactive discord is low stakes in contract, but that it actually is less likely because of several features in contract. And I think these are not accidental. These features, I wouldn't say, are motivated entirely by the desire to avoid reactive discord between parties, but I think that the interest in avoiding that kind of discord is not unrelated to why we see these features in contract. So one of these is the rule of objectivity. So objectivity, the principle of objectivity, which I think is not kind of universal at this point, holds that when we interpret what parties' obligations are in contract, it depends just on the communications and objective actions between the parties, right? So what was going on in the party's head doesn't matter. What matters is what they said and did to each other. Objectivity seems likely to produce harmony rather than reactive discord because, after all, if part of the engine of discord is disagreement about exactly what the obligations are, if we're looking at the same data, hopefully that makes it more likely that we will have a kind of consistent understanding of what our obligations were, right? So if we understand that what controls is what was written on the page, for example, or at least what was said, then the fact that I was secretly thinking something else, I know, is not going to bear on what I owe you. So if we have a mutually understanding that our relationship or our obligations are governed by objectivity, then it kind of tightens the space that determines what our obligations are, and so we are more likely to agree on what those obligations are. Strict liability is another feature of contract that seems likely to reduce disharmony, discord. What is the strict liability feature? Well, that's just that in most of the time in contract, unless the contract itself, you know, specifies otherwise, all that matters is that you breached. It doesn't matter why, right? Putting aside the extreme cases where, you know, like the world fell apart and that's why you didn't deliver your widgets. Most of the time, if I don't give you my widgets on the date that delivery was due, nobody's interested in whether I didn't do whether I tried hard or not, right? And whether I ought to have done something differently, the only question is, did I deliver them or not? So the sphere of facts that speak to whether or not I breached my obligation is far narrower than it would be in a case where, you know, it's like a negligence-based standard, okay, a fault-based standard. Sorry, I have now gotten them. I have to log back into my computer. Okay. All right. So objectivity and strict liability are two things in contract that seem like they would cut to mitigate the likelihood of reactive discord. But maybe the most important feature of contract that seems to cut in this direction is voluntariness. The idea here is that, well, the obligations in contract are just the ones that we agreed to, right? So we have already settled the question of what we owe each other, right? Most of the time when we go about interacting with each other, we don't settle in advance what we owe each other, right? So you walk into a room and you you have not discussed in advance, am I going to hold the door for you? How long am I going to open the door for you? You know, how close to you am I going to stand? We might not even have settled, am I going to wear a mask? Are you going to wear a mask? How loudly can I speak? When can I interrupt, right? When can I leave this conversation and go on to a better one? Like, you know, all of these things are unclear, right? So all the time when we're interacting with each other, we don't have a settled playbook for how we are permitted to interact with each other. In contract, we do, right? We have an agreement that specifies what we owe each other. It looks pretty promising in terms of avoiding discord, right? Because if one, it looks like one of, not only is the disagreement about facts substantially narrower by virtue of objectivity and strict liability, but also disagreement about obligation seems substantially reduced by the fact that we are supposed to have settled our obligations up front. Why then would we ever see it anyway, right? Why then do we still see significant discord in contract? I want to suggest that one of the primary reasons is because consent itself, while resolving one source of discord, produces its own discord. If we agree that we consented, and if we agree about the consequences of consent, then it's great, right? In terms of knowing what we, of being on the same page on our obligations. But it opens up another kind of set of questions about whether or not one party has really consented, and what, how far that consent goes, right? What exactly the implications of that consent are. So there's another set of questions that is produced by consent that I want to suggest systematically produces discord, and a particularly poignant kind of discord, as compared even while certain other sources of discord are resolved. So why is consent likely? And so I just want to put in one more footnote here. So when I say consent, I really mean something more like assent. I don't know if in the translation the distinction is important or not. And to what words you would use in Spanish. But I think, at least in the English language literature, the way I'm using consent is consistent with popular usage of consent, but is maybe closer to how assent is used in some of the older contract literature. Because what I'm suggesting is, you know, when you consent to a contract, you're agreeing to it, right? It's not necessarily that you're agreeing to it as a full-fledged package. It's not necessarily operating strictly as a permission, right? It might include some permissions, but it also includes the promises. You're assenting to the package of obligations and permissions that the contract entails. Okay, so that's what I'm referring to as consent, what we might sometimes think of as assent. So the thing about consent is that it's not just a contract concept, right? Long before anyone enters into a contract or has heard of the concept of contract, we know about consent, because consent has a moral life of its own. We use the concept and rely on the concept of consent to govern our relationships in myriad ways outside of contract. So contract law doesn't get to control the concept and the content of the meaning of consent in the way that it would, for example, the rules of, you know, consideration, which is another particular doctrine. There are many doctrines in contract that don't really directly relate to something outside of contract. So when the law says this is consideration or this is the parole evidence rule, that's pretty much it, right? There isn't kind of like a popular notion out there that it's competing with or that it has to specifically track. But with consent, it's different, because when the law says you have assented to these obligations, they are yours now, a person can, without knowing the law, have a view about that, right? About whether they have, in fact, assented, and whether or not that consent is really binding on them in the particular facts of their case. So there are then, so there's first of all this possibility of a meaningful divergence between an individual's subjective sense of consent and the legal meaning of consent. What I want to go into now is that the concept of consent is ambiguous in a way that actually is not surprising for a kind of popular moral concept, right? So just like I think promise is another one where the concept of promise is used by many people in many different ways. People disagree about when they have made a promise and whether it's binding and under what circumstances it has to be kept and what should happen if they don't keep it. All of this is true with respect to consent as well, if not more so. And so I want to point to several ambiguities that drive a systematic wedge between people's perception of whether there has been consent and what its implications are. And I want to suggest that these ambiguities are going to systematically result in harm sufferers having a narrower understanding of consent than harm inflictors. Because in each of these cases, I'm going to give you four examples of how consent can have, you know, a more or less expansive meaning. There's one version of the ambiguity that relies on a larger set of facts than the other. And the larger set of facts on which it relies are ones that only the harm sufferer, or the consenting party, is likely to have access to. Okay, so one ambiguity in consent is whether it reveals an agent's preferences and whether it even reveals endorsement. So I'm not introducing any new ambiguities here, but I'm just kind of reminding you of ambiguities that I'm sure you have encountered in other places when you thought about consent. So that is, if I consent to buy something, does it show that I prefer that thing over all other things, right, in the way that classic legal economics would tend to assume? When can it be shown to reveal my preferences and when can it not be relied upon to reveal my preferences? Does it even reveal endorsement, right? So if I have assented to certain terms, does it mean that I am kind of okay with them, right? Or can it sometimes be the case that I agree to terms without really signing off on them, but because I merely believe I have no choice, right? Or something like this. Like, when can the fact of my consent to terms be indicative of my endorsement of those terms? And when it can't it be, right? So if I go into the doctor's office, this is another context where consent comes up. If I go into a doctor's office and I agree to waive the doctor's liability for the operation, is it really the case that I am endorsing the waiver of liability, or is it appropriate to say something more like, I really want the surgery, right? And so I take it to be a condition of my being able to get the surgery that I waive my rights, but I'm not really endorsing it in any way. Okay, so sometimes consent seems to indicate that it seems to reveal preferences. Sometimes it seems to indicate an endorsement, and sometimes it doesn't. We also can see that consent is ambiguous as to whether or not it's high or low quality. So for some people, it's just a threshold matter, or you know, you either have consented or you haven't. There's then the question of what the threshold should be. But for other people, it's not a binary choice whether or not you have consented. The question is, how much did you consent? How much can we rely on your consent to justify anything? Right? To what extent does my conduct or the outcome or the allocation of responsibility, to what extent can any of this be justified by reference to your consent? Well, it depends on how quality that consent was. So what speaks to the quality of consent? Well, we can ask, how much information did the person consenting have, right? So did I realize when I signed this agreement that I would be on the hook for paying for the phone service even if my phone broke down, right? Even if I don't have a phone, I still have to pay for the service. How much information did I have? Do I need to know about the probabilities of different states of the world materializing so that I could make a informed decision about it, about whether to enter the contract? Does it depend on deliberation, right? If I made the choice really quickly, am I less bound by that choice, or does it have lesser value than a choice that was the culmination of a lot of deliberation? And what about alternative choices? Does it matter whether I had any other options or not? Again, for some people, you might think, and here I want to point out that for the person making the, for the people, for the consenting person, the person whose consent is at issue, I should say, they have access to all this information, right? So they knew how much they knew or didn't know. They know how much they deliberated or didn't deliberate. They know what alternatives they had. So if they might be then more likely to take into account all that information because it's information that they have. By contrast, the other party to the contract doesn't have any systematic information about how much the other person knew, how much they thought about it, what their alternatives were. So it would be kind of natural for them to discount the significance of all these quality indicators and not take quality to be as important on the question of what they owe the other person now, right? Because they don't, it would be unintuitive to say that what I owe you turns on a variety of facts I don't even know, right? By contrast, as the person who let's say is now trying to get out of the contract, I know that I didn't know that this was going to happen. I know that I never got a chance to think about it. I know that I had no choice, and that's why I didn't think about it. And so I attach significance to all these facts that are not even available to the other party. A third ambiguity is what I call relevance. That speaks to the duration and conditionality of consent. So sometimes consent is kind of instantaneous. Sometimes it lasts forever, right? In different contexts, it has a different lifespan. It also varies in its conditionality. That is, sometimes we might say, yeah, I consented, but that's irrelevant now because there's a pandemic, right? Sure, I consented, but that was when I was 18 and now I'm 42, right? So the relevance of a prior moment of consent is also subject to debate. And again, I would say that the consenting party is more likely to claim that it's relevant, that consent is old and was, you know, generated under different circumstances than is the other party. Finally, consent is ambiguous on the dimension of force. That is, how completely does consent inoculate one party against any kind of responsibility for the other, right? So if I consent to the terms of this loan, does that mean that you can, let's say the loan allows that you can accelerate the payment schedule if I breach one of the covenants? Does that mean now that you have, you know, that it's fine for you to do that, right? Like that even if you have this, even if the contract assigns you the discretion, that because the contract assigns you the discretion, you can recall the loan at that moment and there's no reason why you shouldn't? Or is consent not as powerful as that, so that there are still reasons that apply to you not to call that loan back, right? Are you still subject to moral reasons for not recalling the loan, including the devastation that it would bring on me if you recalled it, right? Or are all those kinds of reasons that might speak to your decision whether to recall the loan kind of wiped clean by the fact of my consent to the terms? So again, we can disagree about how revealing consent is, whether it has a quality and what that quality is. We can disagree about how relevant it is under the current circumstances at the current time, and we might disagree on its force. So, sure, consent is great. It seems to settle what our obligations are vis-a-vis one another, but it turns out to open its own can of worms and be and create its own sources of disagreement, namely on the question of whether consent was present and how operative it is and exactly what it implies for what the parties owe each other. And I think that these disagreements about consent are not just kind of mere possibilities, but they're quite likely to arise because, as I've suggested, the ambiguities in consent tend to correspond to concepts that rely on different sets of facts. And the two parties to contract are going to have access to different sets of facts, and so they're more likely to latch on to a concept of consent that relies on the facts available to them. That's a kind of psychological speculation, to be sure, but I think that we are likely to have the bias of thinking that what we know matters and that what we don't know doesn't when it comes to the question of deciding what our obligations are. Finally, the last thing I want to say is, you know, part of the reason why I'm interested in this is not just contract, like I said, but because it seems to me that this matter of consent is important in so many realms of relations, in the medical context, in the sexual context. There's so many places where it matters, you know, whether or not we have consented or not. And I think that there's something particularly fraught about a dispute about consent, that reactive discord about consent has a sting that isn't true of every other kind of reactive discord. And I think it's because consent is a normative power that speaks to the core of our agency, right? So when you claim not just that you didn't wrong me, but that you didn't wrong me because of something I did, because I gave you permission or changed in some way your rights against me, I think that you're not only just saying that you're not responsible, you're actually shifting the responsibility onto me, right? So it creates even more distance between the parties to discord than would be true of ordinary discord, we might say. Where, and when I say I'm not wrong, what I'm saying is that no one is wrong. But in consent, I'm saying, it's not me, it's you. And I think that has a particular sting. Okay, I actually have no idea where I am for time, but is that like in the ballpark?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks so much for being here.